Death found Pestilence in a hospice in Clamedos. Pestilence liked hospitals. There was always something for him to do. Currently he was trying to remove the "Now wash your hands" sign over a cracked basin. He looked up.
"Oh, it's you," he said.
"Soap? I'll give them soap."
"I sent out the call," said Death.
"Oh, yeah, right, yes," said Pestilence, clearly embarrassed.
"You've still got your horse?"
"Of course, but..."
"You had a fine horse."
"Look, Death, it's... Look, it's not that I don't see your point, but... Oh, excuse me."
Pestilence stepped aside as a white-robed nun, completely ignorant of the two horsemen, passed between them. But he took the opportunity to breathe in her face.
"Just a mild flu," he said, catching Death's expression.
"So we can count on you, can we?"
"To ride out?"
"Yes."
"For the big one?"
"It's expected of us."
"How many of the others have you got?"
"You are the first."
Death sighed. Of course, there had been plenty of diseases long before humans had been around, but humans had definitely created Pestilence. They had a genius for crowding together, for poking around in jungles, for sighting the midden so handily next to the well. Pestilence was, therefore, part human, with all that this entailed. He was frightened.
"I see," he said.
"The way you put it..."
"You are afraid?"
"I'll think about it."
"Yes, I am sure you will."
Tick. Quite a lot of brandy splashed into Mrs. Ogg's mug. She waved the bottle vaguely at Susan with an inquiring look. "No, thank you."
"Fair enough, fair enough."
Nanny Ogg put the bottle aside and took a draught of the brandy as though it were beer.
"A man came knocking," she said. "Three times he came in my life. Last time was, oh, maybe 10 days ago. Same man every time. He wanted a midwife."
10 days ago," said Susan. "But the boy's at least 6..." She stopped.
"Ah, you've got it," said Mrs. Ogg. "I could see you was bright. Time didn't matter to him. He wanted the best midwife. And it was like he'd found out about me but got the date wrong. Just like you or me could knock on the wrong door. Can you understand what I mean?"
"More than you think," said Susan.
"The third time," another gulp at the brandy, "he was in a bit of a state," said Mrs. Ogg. "That's how I knew he was just a man, despite everything that happened after. It was because he was panicking, to tell you the truth. Pregnant fathers often panic. He was going on about me coming right away, and how there was no time. He had all the time in the world, he just wasn't thinking properly. Because husbands never do when the time comes. They panic because it ain't their world anymore."
"And what happened next?" said Susan.
"He took me in his... well, it was like one of them old chariots. He took me to..."
Mrs. Ogg hesitated.
"I've seen a lot of strange things in my life, I'll have you know," she said, as if preparing the ground for a revelation.
"I can believe it."
"It was a castle made of glass."
Mrs. Ogg gave Susan a look which dared her to disbelieve. Susan decided to hurry things up. "Mrs. Ogg, one of my earliest memories is of helping to feed the pale horse. You know, the one outside, the horse of death. His name is Binky, so please don't keep stopping. There is practically no limit to the things I find normal."
"There was a woman. Well, eventually there was a woman," said the witch. "Can you imagine someone exploding into a million pieces?"
"Yeah, I expect you can."
"Well, imagine it happening the other way. There is a mist, and it's all flying together, and then, whoosh, there is a woman. Then, whoosh, back into a mist again. And all the time this noise..."
Mrs. Ogg ran her finger round the edge of the brandy glass, making it hum. "A woman kept incarnating and then disappearing again. Why?"
"Because she was frightened, of course. First time, see?"
Mrs. Ogg grinned.
"I personally never had any problems in that area, but I've been at a lot of births when it's all new to the girl, and she'll be frightened as hell, and when push comes to shove, if you take my meaning, she'll be yelling and swearing at the father, and I reckon that she'd give anything to be somewhere else." "Well, this lady could be somewhere else. We'd have been in a real pickle if it wasn't for the man, as it turned out."
"The man that brought you?"
"He was kind of foreign, you know, like the other people. Bald as a coot. I remember thinking, 'You look like a young man, mister. But you look like you've been a young man for a long, long time, if I'm any judge.' Normally, I wouldn't have any man there, but he sat and talked to her in his foreign lingo and sang her songs and little poems and soothed her, and back she came out with thin air, and I was ready, and it was one, two done. Then she was gone, except that she was still there, I think, in the air.
What does she look like? Said Susan.
Mrs. Ogg gave her a look. You've got to remember the view I got where I was sitting, she said. The kind of description I might give you ain't a thing anyone will put on a poster, if you get my meaning. And no woman looks at her breast at a time like that. She was young. She had dark hair.
Mrs. Ogg refilled her brandy glass, and this meant the pause went on for some time.
And she was old, too, if you're after the truth of it. Not old like me, I mean old.
She stared at the fire.
Old like darkness and stars, she said to the flames.
The boy was left outside the Thieves' Guild, said Susan, to break the silence. I suppose they thought that with gifts like that, he'd be all right.
The boy? He? What do you mean, he?
Tick. Lady Le Jean was being strong. She'd never realized how much humans were controlled by their bodies. The thing nagged night and day. It was always too hot, too cold, too empty, too full, too tired. The key was discipline, she was sure. Auditors were immortal. If she couldn't tell her body what to do, she didn't deserve to have one. Bodies were a major human weakness. Senses, too. The auditors had hundreds of senses, since every possible phenomenon had to be witnessed and recorded. She could find only five available now. Five ought to be easy to deal with, but they were wired directly into the rest of the body. They didn't just submit information, they made demands. She'd walked past a stall selling roasted meats, and her mouth had started to drool. The sense of smell wanted the body to eat without consulting the brain. But that wasn't the worst part. The brain itself did its own thinking. That was the hardest part. The bag of soggy tissue behind the eyes worked away independently of its owner. It took in information from the senses and checked them against memory and presented options. Sometimes the hidden parts of it even fought for control of the mouth. Humans weren't individuals, they were, each one, a committee. Some of the other members of the committee were dark and red and entirely uncivilized. They had joined the brain before civilization. Some of them had got aboard even before humanity. And the bit that did the joined-up thinking had to fight in the darkness of the brain to get the casting vote. After little more than a couple of weeks as a human, the entity that was Lady Le Jean was having real trouble. Food, for example. Auditors did not eat. They recognized that feeble life forms had to consume one another to obtain energy and bodybuilding material. The process was astonishingly inefficient, however, and her ladyship had tried assembling nutrients directly out of the air. This worked, but the process felt... What was the word? Oh, yes. Creepy. Besides, part of the brain didn't believe it was getting fed and insisted that it was hungry. Its incessant nagging interfered with her thought processes, and so, despite everything, she'd had to face up to the whole... Well, the whole orifices business. The auditors had known about these for a long time. The human body appeared to have up to eight of them. One didn't seem to work, and the rest appeared to be multifunctional, although surprisingly, there looked to be only one thing that could be done by the ears. So yesterday, she'd tried a piece of dried toast. It had been the single worst experience of her existence. It had been the single most intense experience of her existence. It had been something else, too. As far as she could understand the language, it had been enjoyable. It seemed that the human sense of taste was quite different from the sense as employed by an auditor. That was precise, measured, analytical. But the human sense of taste was like being hit in the mouth by the whole world. It had been half an hour of watching fireworks in her head before she remembered to swallow. How did humans survive this? She'd been fascinated by the art galleries. It was clear that some humans could present reality in a way that made it even more real, that spoke to the viewer, that seared the mind. But what could possibly transcend the knowledge that the genius of an artist had to poke alien substances into his face? Could it be that humans had got used to it? And that was only the start. The sooner the clock was finished, the better. A species as crazy as this couldn't be allowed to survive.
She was visiting the clockmaker and his ugly assistant every day now, giving them as much help as she dared, but they always seemed one vital step away from completion. Amazing. She could even lie to herself. Because another voice in her head, which was part of the Dark Committee, said, "You're not helping, are you? You're stealing parts and twisting parts, and you go back every day because of the way he looks at you, don't you?" Parts of the internal committee, that were so old that they didn't have voices, only direct control of the body, tried to interfere at this point, and she tried to put them out of her mind. And now she had to face the other auditors. They would be punctual. She pulled herself together. Water had taken to running out of her eyes lately for no reason at all. She did the best she could with her hair and made her way to the large drawing room. Greyness was already filling the air. In this space there was not room for too many auditors, but that did not really matter. One could speak for all. Lady Lejean found the corners of her mouth turned up automatically as nine of them appeared. Nine was three threes, and the auditors liked threes. Two would keep an eye on the other one. Each two would keep an eye on each other one. "They don't trust themselves," said one of the voices in her head. Another voice cut in, "It's we. We don't trust ourselves." And she thought, "Oh yes, we, not they. I must remember I'm a we." An auditor said, "Why is there no further progress?" The corners of the mouth turned down again. "There have been minor problems of precision and alignment," said Lady Lejean. She found that her hands were rubbing themselves together slowly, and wondered why. She hadn't told them to. Auditors had never needed body language, so they didn't understand it. One said, "What is the nature of..." But another one cut in with, "Why are you dwelling in this building?" The voice was tinted with suspicion. "The body requires one to do things that cannot be done on the street," said Lady Lejean. And because she'd got to know something about Ankh-Morpork, she added, "At least, on many streets. Also, I believe the servant of the clockmaker is suspicious. I have allowed the body to yield to gravity, since that is what it was designed for. It is as well to give the appearance of humanity." One, and it was the same one, said, "And what is the meaning of these?" It had noticed the paints and the easel. Lady Lejean wished fervently that she'd remembered to put them away. The one said, "You are making an image with pigments."
"Yes, very badly, I'm afraid."
One said, "For what reason?"
"I wish to see how humans do it."
One said, "That is simple. The eye receives the input. The hand applies the pigment."
"That's what I thought, but it appears to be much more complex than that."
The one who had raised the question of the painting drifted towards one of the chairs and said, "And what is this?"
"It is a cat. It arrived. It does not appear to wish to depart."
The cat, a feral Ginger Tom, flicked a serrated ear and curled up in a tighter ball. Anything that could survive in Ankh-Morpork's alleys, with their abandoned swamp dragons, dog packs and furriers' agents, was not about to even open one eye for a bunch of floating nightdresses. The one who was now getting on Lady Lejean's nerves said, "And the reason for its presence?"
"It appears to tolerate the company of apparent humans, asking nothing in return but food, water, shelter and comfort," said Lady Lejean. "This interests me. Our purpose is to learn, and thus I have, as you can see, begun."
She hoped it sounded better to them than it did to her. One said, "When will the clock problems you spoke of be resolved?"
"Oh, soon, very soon, yes."
The one that was beginning to terrify Lady Lejean said, "We wonder, is it possible that you are slowing the work in some way?" Lady Lejean felt a prickling on her forehead. Why was it doing that?
"No. Why should I slow the work? There would be no logic to it."
One said, And an auditor did not say by accident. Had a very precise meaning. It went on, "You are making moisture on your head.
Yes, it's a body thing, one said.
Yes. And that, too, had a very specific and ominous meaning.
One said, We wonder if too long in a solid body weakens resolve.
Also, we find it hard to see your thoughts.
Body again, I'm afraid. The brain is a very imprecise instrument.
Lady Lejeune got control of her hands at last. One said, Yes. Another said, When water fills a jug, it takes the shape of the jug. But the water is not the jug, nor is the jug the water.
Of course, said Lady Lejeune, and inside a thought that she hadn't known she was thinking, a thought that turned up out of the darkness behind the eyes, said, We are the most stupid creatures in the universe.
One said, It is not good to act alone.
She said, Of course. And once again a thought emerged from the darkness. I'm in trouble now.
One said, And therefore you will have companions. No blame attaches. One should never be alone. Together, resolve is strengthened.
Motes began to twinkle in the air. Lady Lejeune's body backed away automatically, and when she saw what was forming, she backed it away further. She had seen humans in all states of life and death, but seeing a body being spun out of raw matter was curiously disquieting when you were currently inhabiting a similar one. It was one of those times when the stomach did the thinking, and thought it wanted to throw up. Six figures took shape, blinked, and opened their eyes. Three of the figures were male, three were female. They were dressed in human-sized equivalents of the auditor's robes. The remaining auditors drew back, but one said, They will accompany you to the clockmaker, and matters will be resolved today. They will not eat or breathe.
Ha! Thought one of the little voices that made up Lady Lejeune's thinking.
One of the figures whimpered. The body will breathe, said her ladyship. You will not persuade it that air is not required. She was aware of the choking noises. You are thinking, yes, we can exchange necessary materials with the outside world, and this is true, she went on. But the body does not know that. It thinks it is dying. Let it breathe.
There was a series of gasps.
And you will feel better shortly, said her ladyship, and was enthralled to hear the inner voice think. These are your jailers, and you are already stronger than them.
One of the figures felt its face with a clumsy hand, and, panting, said, Whom do you speak to with your mouth?
You, said Lady Lejeune.
Us?
This will take some explaining.
No, said the auditor. Danger lies that way. We believe the body imposes a method of thought on the brain. No blame attaches. It is a malfunction. We will accompany you to the clockmaker. We will do this now.
Not in those clothes, said Lady Lejeune. You will frighten him. It may lead to irrational actions.
There was a moment of silence. The auditors made flesh looked hopelessly at one another.
You have to talk with your mouth, Lady Lejeune prompted. The minds stay inside the head.
One said, What is wrong with these clothes? It is a simple shape found in many human cultures.
Lady Lejeune walked to the window. See the people down there, she said. You must dress in appropriate city fashions.
Reluctantly, the auditors did so, and while they retained the greyness, they did give themselves clothes that would pass unnoticed in the street. Up to a point, anyway.
Only those of female appearance should wear dresses, Lady Lejeune pointed out.
A hovering grey shape said, Warning. Danger. The one calling itself Lady Lejeune may give unsafe advice. Warning.
Understood, said one of the incarnate ones. We know the way. We will lead.
It walked into the door. The auditors clustered around the door for a while, and then one of them glared at Lady Lejeune, who smiled.
"Doorknob," she said. The auditor turned back to the door, stared at the brass knob, and then looked the door up and down. It dissolved into dust.
"Doorknob was simpler," said Lady Lejean. "Tick."
There were big mountains round the hub, but the ones towering above the temple didn't all have names, because there were simply too many of them. Only gods have enough time to name all the pebbles on a beach, but gods don't have the patience. Copperhead was small enough to be big enough to have a name. Lobsang awoke and saw its crooked peak, towering above the lesser local mountains outlined against the sunrise. Sometimes the gods have no taste at all. They allow sunrises and sunsets in ridiculous pink and blue hues that any professional artist would dismiss as the work of some enthusiastic amateur who'd never looked at a real sunset. This was one of those sunrises. It was the kind of sunrise a man rises and looks at and says, "No real sunrise could paint the sky, surgical appliance, pink." Nevertheless, it was beautiful, but not tasteful. Lobsang was half covered in a pile of dry bracken. There was no sign of the Yeti. It was springtime here. There was still snow, but with the occasional patch of bare soil and a hint of green. He stared around and saw leaves in bud. Lutse was standing some way off, gazing up into a tree. He didn't turn his head as Lobsang approached. "Where's the Yeti?"
"He wouldn't go further than this. Can't ask a Yeti to leave snow," whispered Lutse.
"Oh," whispered Lobsang.
"Why are we whispering?" "Look at the bird."
It was perched on a branch by a fork in the tree, next to what looked like a birdhouse, and nibbling at a piece of roughly round wood it held in one claw.
"Must be an old nest they're repairing," said Lutse. "Can't have got that advanced this early in the season."
"It looks like some kind of old box to me," said Lobsang. He squinted to see it better.
"Is it an old clock?" he added. "Look at what the bird is nibbling," suggested Lutse.
"Well, it looks like a crude gear wheel, but why?"
"Well spotted. That, lad, is a clock cuckoo. A young one, by the look of it, trying to build a nest that'll attract a mate. Not much chance of that, see? It's got the numerals all wrong, and it's stuck the hands on crooked."
"A bird that builds clocks? I thought a cuckoo clock was a clock with a mechanical cuckoo that came out when—"
"And where do you think people got such a strange idea from?"
"That's some kind of miracle."
"Why?" said Lutse. "They barely go for more than half an hour. They keep lousy time, and the poor dumb males go frantic trying to keep them wound."
"But even to—"
"Everything happens somewhere, I suppose," said Lutse. "Not worth making too much of a fuss. Got any food left?"
No, we finished it last night," said Lobsang. He added, hopefully,
"I heard tell that really advanced monks can live on the, life force in the actual air itself."
"Only on the planet Sausage, I expect," said Lutse. "No, we'll skirt Copperhead and find something in the valleys on the other side. Let's go, there's not much time."
But time enough to watch a bird, thought Lobsang, as he let the world around him become blue and fade, and the thought was comforting. It was easier going without the snow on the ground, provided he avoided the strange resistance offered by bushes and long grass. Lutse walked on ahead, looking oddly colourful and unreal against the faded landscape. They went past the entrance to dwarf mines, but saw no one above ground. Lobsang was glad of that. The statues he had seen in the villages yesterday weren't dead, he knew, but merely frozen at a different speed of time. Lutse had forbidden him to go near anyone, but he needn't have bothered. Walking around the living statues was invasive somehow. It made it worse when he realized that they were moving, but very, very slowly. The sun had barely moved from the horizon when they came down through warmer woods on the rim side of the mountain. Here the landscape had a more domesticated air. It was woodland rather than forest. The game trail they'd been following crossed a creek at a point where there were cart tracks, old but still not overgrown. Lobsang looked behind him after he'd walked across the ford, and watched the water very slowly reclaim the shape of his footprints in the stream. He'd been trained in time-slicing on the snowfields above the valley, like the rest of the novices. That was so they couldn't come to any harm, the monks had said, although no one actually explained what harm they might come to. Outside the monastery, this was the first time Lobsang had sliced in a living landscape. It was marvellous. Birds hung in the sky. Early morning bumblebees hovered over the opening flowers. The world was a crystal made of living things. Lobsang slowed near a group of deer, cropping the grass.
and watched as the nearest eye of one of them swivelled, with geological slowness, to watch him. He saw the skin move as the muscles underneath started to bunch for flight.
"Time for a smoke-o," said Lutsang.
The world around Lobsang speeded up. The deer fled, along with the magic of the moment.
"What's a smoke-o?" said Lobsang. He was annoyed. The quiet, slow world had been fun.
"You ever been to 4X?"
"No. There's a barman at the Bunch of Grapes from there, though." Lutse lit one of his skinny cigarettes.
"Don't mean much," he said. "The barman everywhere is from there. Strange country. Big time source right in the middle. Very useful. Time and space all tangled up. Probably all that beer. Nice place, though. Now, you see that country down there?"
On one side of the clearing, the ground fell away steeply, showing treetops and, beyond, a small patchwork of fields tucked into a fold in the mountains. In the distance was a gorge, and Lobsang thought he could make out a bridge across it.
"Doesn't look much like a country," he said. "Looks more like a shelf."
"That's which country?" said Lutse. "And we're going to borrow a broomstick. Quickest way to Ankh-Morpork. Only way to travel."
"Isn't that, interfering with history? I mean, I was told that sort of thing is all right up in the valleys, but down here in the world..."
"Oh, it's absolutely forbidden," said Lutse. "'Cause it's interfering with history. Got to be careful of your witch, of course. Some of them are pretty canny."
He caught Lobsang's expression.
"Look, that's why there's rules, understand, so that you think before you break 'em."
"But..." Lutse sighed and pinched out the end of his cigarette.
"We're being watched," he said.
Lobsang spun round. There were only trees and insects buzzing in the early morning air.
"Up there," said Lutse.
There was a raven perched on the broken crown of a pine tree, shattered in some winter storm. It looked at them, looking at it.
"Caw?"
it said. "It's just a raven," said Lobsang. "There's lots of them in the valley."
"It was watching us when we stopped.
There's ravens all over the mountains, Sweeper."
"And when we met the Yeti," Lutse persisted.
"That settles it, then. It's a coincidence. One raven couldn't move that fast."
"Maybe it's a special raven," said Lutse. "Anyway, it's not one of our mountain ravens. It's a lowland raven. Mountain ravens croak. They don't caw. Why is it so interested in us?"
"It's a bit weird, thinking you're being followed by a bird," said Lobsang.
"When you get to my age, you notice things in the sky," said Lutse.
He shrugged and gave a grin.
"You start worrying they might be vultures."
They faded into time and vanished. The raven ruffled its feathers.
"Croak," it said. "Damn!"
Tick! Lobsang felt around under the thatched eaves of the cottage, and his hand closed on the bristles of a broomstick that had been thrust amongst the reeds. "This is rather like stealing," he said, as Lutse helped him down.
"No, it's not," said the sweeper,
taking the broomstick and holding it up so he could look along its length.
"And I'll tell you why. If we sort things out, we'll drop it off on our way back, and she'll never know it's gone. And if we don't sort things out, well, she'll still never know it's gone. Honestly, they don't take much care of their sticks, witches. Look at the bristles on this one. I wouldn't use this to clean a pond. Oh, well, back into clock time, lad. I'd hate to fly one of these things while I was slicing."
He straddled the stick and gripped the handle. It rose a little way.
"Good suspension, at least," he said. "Now you can have the comfy seat on the back. Hold tight to my own broom and make sure you wrap your robe around you. These things are pretty breezy."
Lobsang pulled himself aboard and the stick rose. As it drew level with the lower branches around the clearing, it brought Lutse to eye level with the raven. It shifted uneasily and turned its head this way and that, trying to fix both eyes on him.
"Are you going to caw or croak, I wonder?" said Lutse, apparently to himself.
"Croak," said the raven.
"So you're not the raven we saw on the other side of the mountain, then?"
"Me?
Gosh, no," said the raven. "That's croaking territory over there." "Just checking."
The broom rose higher and set off above the trees in a hubwards direction. The raven ruffled its feathers and blinked.
"Damn,"
it said. It shuffled around the tree to where the Death of Rats was sitting.
"Squeak! Look, if you want me to do this undercover work, you've got to get me a book on ornithology, okay?"
said Quoth.
"Let's go, or I'll never keep up."
Tick!